This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
When we opened the doors of Slot nearly 20 years ago, it was in part thanks to the guiding ideas and vision of an engineer by the name of Billy Kluver and his longtime collaborator and partner, Julie Marden. And Billy and Julie officially launched an organization called Experiments in Art and Technology in 1967, together with Fred Waldauer and the artist Robert Rauschenberg and Robert Whitman. They initiated and carried out projects about kind of the role of the artist in contemporary society, which they sought to expand. But they also wanted to explore the relationship of the individual to technological change and democratic life. This vision of a collaborative model of cultural production, one that joins art and technology, has remained with us since the very beginning of this organization and forms part of the context in which the present exhibition can be situated and in which it intervenes. This context also includes various other projects and initiatives at Slot, including 2 decades now of dedicated programming around issues of race, inequality, poverty, and dispossession in America and across the globe, featuring activists and community voices both directly impacted by and working to challenge the primary injustices of our time, as well as in recent years our Health Ecologies Lab, which is a project which seeks to make visible the impact of social systems and structural violence and state violence on individuals and communities, but also our Listening Lab project, which is a trauma-informed storytelling initiative which affirms and celebrates listening as essential to the work of healing, and which involves over 44,000 healthcare providers in this region, as well as their broader patient and caregiver communities that they serve. So many of these programs have advocated for the arts as an indispensable method of imagining justice and making democracy. But also, they've sought to model how, in the face of suffering and devastation, the arts are perhaps our most enduring resources for processing, coping, and surviving the various forms of trauma that have always defined life in America and beyond. So as I mentioned before, the programs that often happen here are developed in collaboration with community organizations and partners, and they've always sought to affirm and to elevate histories and stories of the struggle for justice in Philadelphia and beyond. If they've sought to transform sociocultural norms and create openings for change to occur, they have also served equally importantly as opportunities to model new approaches to listening and collaboration. We hope that one of the many things that tonight's program will do is to help us reflect on how to better care for each other, but also how to think together and with each other in these uniquely challenging times. So the project that surrounds you, this amazing project that we're all here to celebrate tonight and learn about tonight, is entitled Gas Exchanges and the Right to Breathe. It seeks to explore the life and death stakes of breathing and the different ways in which the access to breath reveals the structures of injustice that so often determine who can breathe and who cannot. Demonstrating the effects on breathing wrought by climate change, environmental violence, and resource extraction, the exhibition points to all the different ways in which breath can be taken away, not only through the ongoing destruction of the globe's biodiversity, but also, as we have all experienced these last 2 years, by a pandemic that has caused nearly 1 million deaths here in the United States and nearly 7 million deaths worldwide. And that has wreaked its worst effects in its capacity to stop breath altogether. And not simply because we can all potentially carry the death of the other in our own breath. What the exhibition shows is that some breaths are considered worthy of protection, while others are rendered worthless. So thank you again for joining us this evening. I'm going to turn things over to Drani. Drani will moderate a conversation with community activist Barbara Bullard, president of the Shirley Chisholm Institute. There's a photograph of Shirley Chisholm in the vault in a permanent exhibit, so I look forward to showing that to you later. We'll also be hearing from Alice Jay, founder of Sister Survivors Detroit, and of course, Hawk Newsom, co-founder of Black Lives Matter New York.
Thank you. I'd love to ask Hawk and Barbara and Alice, I think Alice is here, to come on up and have a seat next to me here. So to give you just a bit of an overview of what we've been up to is taking this series of portraits and videos and breaths, really the idea is to utilize the force of breath, the convening power of breath, the centering of breath, to bring together extraordinary individuals who are doing amazing work to make our world better and to help create a more just and equitable world. Using breath is an incredible metaphor because it's so physical. There's a material aspect, but it's also really stands for spirit. It's in so many cultures, you have the idea of prana or chi, or every culture around the world has a focus around breath that is really beautiful and really speaks to that part of us that is beyond our intellect, our consciousness, our connection to the greater good, however you want to describe it. And I think that what attracted me to this project was the idea that everyone experiences what it's like to not be able to breathe. Everyone can understand. You might not have ever walked in the shoes of someone who's advocating for a cause that's just very distant from your life, but you know what it's like to not be able to breathe. So when we connect through this framing of breath, we can find a way to create empathy and to create a togetherness, to create harmony between all these wonderful advocates who are working in different ways to make the world better. So I'd love to turn it over to you, to this wonderful group of speakers who've joined me here today. We have Alice J, Hawk Newsom, and Barbara Bullard, and I'm going to pass this to you. These guys have mics, but we can do the mic as well, just don't hold it too close. So I'm going to start with asking each of our speakers here to just share a few words about themselves and why it is that breath is important in their worlds and in the work that they're doing. Alice, can I start with you?
Yeah.
Or should I give you a moment?
Hi, I'm Alice, and I am a survivor of child abduction, human trafficking, and sexual exploitation over 17 years. The right to breathe is so important to me because of the stigma and ostracization, I guess I want to say, and just my basic rights and my human rights were stolen, and I was invisible.
After you, please. Oh, thank you, sir. Hi, everybody. The right to breathe. That's in all of our DNAs. That's in the walls, the floors, the ceilings. And it's interesting that the year 17 just came up because I had been in an abusive marriage for 17 years, running for my life, only having 24 hours to leave, and I left everything behind. From that, I found yoga, or maybe yoga found me. And through that, I found the essence of the black man, the black yogi that is male, that was finding his own sovereignty through his breath.
How do I follow that? It's like, there's so many smart people up here, and then there's me. No. Hawk Newsom. I am a servant of humanity. I am a servant of Christ. I found my way in the Black Lives Matter movement. I found who I am, right? I'm a fighter. I'm a freedom fighter. I'm someone sent here purposely to help liberate my people. And it's amazing how this sinks in Drani, because the rallying cry for the movement that I'm a leader in is I can't breathe. But when you think about how that applies and how this system, this oppressive, racist country continues to apply pressure to us to keep their foots, their knees on our necks. There's just so many different ways to fight. So when we talk about systemic racism, we're talking about environmental violence. I'm stealing your term. We're talking about financial literacy and the lack thereof in our communities. We're talking about police violence. We're talking about all forms of state violence. And there's just so much to think about and to fight. But I believe the Bible said, what greater love is there than to lay down your life for another's? So we fight, we put our lives on the line so that our people can have the right to breathe.
Thank you so much. Alice, I'd love to share just a little bit of your wonderful work. Alice is the founder of Sister Survivors. She's also the author of Out of the Darkness, and she's doing amazing work on the ground to help women who have been through the most terrible of situations. And so each of the speakers here today, they're not just people who are talking about problems. They're actually finding ways to solve major challenges in the world. And so I'd love to ask you, Alice, to just talk a little bit about the work that you're doing.
Right. So I'm a human rights activist as well, and I am a victim specialist, and I have created programs for survivors. The survivors that I work with, a lot of them don't know that they're being trafficked. They don't understand what they're in. They just don't see a way out. And so my challenge is to give them a new objective and a new understanding, and so and help them be able to see their way out. And you know, in our society, there it's so amazing to me because there is only like 15 states that say if a child is caught with a grown up and the money is exchanged, that she's not a prostitute. And civil law says that if I'm not 18 years old, I don't have the right to consent. So it is actually against the law to call her a prostitute. And so understanding that in our society that we have made this a rite of passage to violate another human being, to seek out the most vulnerable beings on the planet who have no ID, no birth certificate, no social security card, no place to live, no family support, no God of their understanding, and then throw money at their feet and say, you know, this is a job. But I ask you, like, you know, to think about that. Like, if there is option implies a choice. If there is no choice, then how is it an option? You know, and I just think as a moral society, we really have to stand in the gap for those who can't defend themselves. And I've met several women over the ages of like who've been in a life many, many years since they were 12 and 13 years old, some as young as 5, and who were trafficked by their families. And yet they're grown and they still have not figured out any other way to live. And yet we continue to try to say in our society that she somehow signed up for that. And that's not reality. That's so far from reality that, you know, and they have a right to exist. They have a name. They have a face. They have a family. They have a brother. They have a sister. They're somebody's daughter. That's God's child, right? And so for us to ignore them is taking away their right to breathe. For us to just not even acknowledge that there's a crime being committed takes away their rights to breathe, to exist. Thanks.
I hear you.
Tying that in, Barbara's work with yoga in the prison system, you know, the different forms of imprisonment that we have, the different forms of slavery in our modern world. Alice is literally slavery, but the prison system is another form of slavery.
Absolutely. One out of every 45 black men are incarcerated. I'm not talking about jail. I'm not talking about in a holding cell. I'm talking about incarcerated. So if you add that space of not minimizing jail or being held, add those numbers, right? It's really, really shocking. The labor system, the systematic erasure of black men in this country. And it's big business. The thing is that what we've been working on, I'm so like blessed that Indrani and GK are working with me on the Concrete Yogi Project, you know, where we're actually going in and we're talking to these men that have chosen yoga as their breath, right? In a system that does not want yoga to be taught or shared, okay? In a system that rejects even free yoga books sent to the systematic unjust. In a system that don't want them to heal and don't want them to breathe. And lastly, I'd just like to say that, you know, all of us, the breath, you know, I encourage everyone to explore their own breath and how it activates your brain cells. It removes the stress. It provides clarity. Imagine if someone's saying to you, you can't do that for yourself.
When I think of the right to breathe as it pertains to systemic racism and anti-blackness in America, our forefathers said, you know, we're entitled to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, right? So that liberty component is freedom. And at its core, the right to breathe is the most basic freedom that anyone can have, right? Like, without that, we have no life. So when I fight this fight, when we fight this fight against these systems, it's, how can I put this? I feel like I'm trying to word it eloquently, but fuck it, I'm gonna be me, right? When we fight against this system, right? This system that has its foot on our necks. We live in communities that are patrolled like by police officers that act as overseers, like we're on a plantation. We go to blanks, we have similar credit scores and histories as white folk, and we get denied. I'm working with a black doctor who went to school her whole life and took her first paycheck to a Chase bank, and they called the cops on her because they thought she was a scammer, right? We are suffocated in the foods that we are fed. We live in a food apartheid where we can't even get decent food to eat. Our educational system sucks, right? There's so many different things happening that are suppressing us, that are suffocating us. You have to think that this is the American way. It's just as American as apple pie, that this is America's intent to keep us poor, desperate, incarcerated, and begging for air. But what we represent with, you know, what was Black Opportunities, what was Black Lives Matter, with Black is now Black Opportunities, is a movement that is saying we're tired of begging. Fuck you. If you want to deny us our rights, we'll fight you every step of the way, be it cerebrally, be it physically, however we got to go about it. We are tired of being oppressed, right? So let me qualify the cerebral, because I'm 6'5 and 330 pounds. The physical is covered, right? It's covered, right? So the cerebral, we've passed 7 laws since our inception in 2016. When the world was on fire, our now ex-governor, Andrew Cuomo, called and said, hey, Hawk, we need to calm the city down. I'm going to put you on a commercial throughout the area and let you talk about how better days are to come. I said, fuck you. I want legislature. So we presented them with 20 pieces of legislature or legislative suggestions, and we got 5 bills passed, right? Thank you. We have a school in the Bronx that Androni and GK came to. It's the only true Montessori school in the Bronx. We give our kids a $50,000 education for free. Okay. We thank you. Thank you. I really appreciate it. We have we teach from an indigenous model, and we have fifth graders who are doing multiplication. I'm sorry, 5 year olds that are doing multiplication. And this is just awesome. We've fed 50,000 people in the last 3 years. We kind of started this thing called the People's Food Program during COVID, when we recognized that our communities were impacted the most. We petitioned the mayor and the governor to get resources to our communities, and we started delivering food to 250 doors daily. And that free food program has continued. We've done a lot, and I think the feather in our hat is when Donald Trump called us personally a group of terrorists and accused us of treason. I said, if he's saying that about us, then we must be doing something right.
Thank you, Hawk. It's so inspiring to hear all that's being done. Obviously, there's so much more that needs to be done. Alice, if I can pass it back to you again, and maybe if you could share with us just a little bit of what you're doing to help the young women or women of all ages to.
Yeah, he had said something and it clicked. Like, you know, I remember in Detroit, right? And I'm from Detroit, and we went to Lansing, and I went before the Senate, and they had 13 bills. And I went before the Senate and I shared my story with them. And you could hear the in the room. And it was like nobody could breathe as long as I was talking. and I told them, I was like, you know, they don't have to look for homeless, unwanted children like me anymore. See, because that was an excuse for people to violate me and traffic me, right? Because they're on the PlayStations and the cell phones and the televisions of your children. So now what you gonna do? And I could hear the Spirit breathing life into me. And He told me that my life had not been in vain. And that was that moment when I knew that what I had been through was going to touch so many people, and that I had the ability to slay dragons with this breath, right? And they put the bills on the floor. He said, put the bills on the floor. Yes, 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 yes. Next bill, yes, yes, yes. Next bill, yes, yes, yes. Next bill, yes, yes, yes. 9 bills passed in my presence, and they were not able to say no as long as I was in that room. They had to take a break. They had to clear the room. You know, and I'm so grateful, you know, that I had that opportunity, and it allowed me to be able to see that it was more to me than just my story, and that I had, you know, and so I wrote the book, and I realized I had like so much information, and I created programs for women. I created one with the 36th District Court. I created one with Neighborhood Legal Services Michigan. I created a workbook that is now in 5 nonprofits within my city, where I go into jails, institutions, shelters, group homes, and I talk to the people about human trafficking, because I seen so many different organizations that were raising awareness and they were fundraising, but the people that it was happening to didn't know what it was, so they couldn't get the help. And so my challenge has been to go into these places and talk to these people, because I had been in those places. I had been in shelters. I had been in recovery homes, and I had never heard the word. And so I didn't want any other person to go through 10 years of recovery and not even know that they were not a criminal, that they were a victim.
Thank you, Alice. Barbara.
What do you
want to share after that? That's so powerful.
Well, I could say that also I am president of the Shirley Chisholm Cultural Institute and have been bringing her legacy back. I've been working on her legacy for almost 2 decades when people didn't know who she was. Now they're saying her name now, which is great. The Institute actually is providing virtual reality and a lot of platforms for our community so that they can actually have a chance to actually outreach to young people that may not want to go to college or can't afford to go to college, but yet they have the brilliance, you know. And one of the things that I had mentioned to Indrani over lunch is, you know, I'll say this very quickly, I had a moment in the middle of Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn, where a number of children almost the age of 5 to 12 circled me and wanted to hurt me, right? They wanted to hurt me because I didn't cross the street when they came down. I had a lot of bags and I didn't cross the street. And they were so used to the community being afraid of them. These are products, these are children that their parents are incarcerated. They came after me, the 5-year-old came after me with a broken bottle, the 11-ish came after me with a tree, and then the head of the group, she must have been 12 years old, wanted me to call the popo. She said, call 50, call 50. And I looked at her, and I looked at every last one of those children in the middle of the street, and I told them all I love them. And when I told them I loved them, they all backed up like I said something really bad. And I said to them, if no one in your life has ever told you that you are loved or they love you, I love you. I love you. And they ran down the street. And the next day, I saw one of the children. His eyes was different. I looked into his eyes. He smiled at me. I smiled back at him. I winked. He recognized me. He was a different child within 24 hours. And lastly, I'd like to say, when I looked into those eyes of those children when that happened, they reminded me of the forgotten children in India, where I was, where I stayed for a while. The forgotten children of India had the same eyes of lostness, the same eyes of that no one cares. So all I'm gonna say is that even those children deserve to breathe. They deserve to understand what the breath is. They deserve to understand that the power is in the breath. Thank you.
Wow. So tying this back into freedom, being liberty, and how that symbolically is our right to breathe in this country, freedom can be purchased. Right? When you get accused of a crime, it's more about your socioeconomic status than anything else. If you will be prosecuted or you will go to jail. So I feel like a lot of you may know this, but a lot of you may not. And I have to take this opportunity to enlighten you. Those kids in Bed-Stuy, these kids in the South Bronx, the kids in the South Ward, in the Fifth Ward of Houston, the kids in Atlanta, the kids who are out here tearing things apart are doing so because they are poor, and that poverty breeds trauma, and that trauma leads to all kinds of mental illness, all kinds of anger, and just these feelings of hopelessness. And when you are hopeless, nothing matters. When you don't give a fuck about you, when you don't love you, why should you care about anyone else? So let's talk about how they got there. The biggest ways to transcend, we're still talking about, because money is the right to breathe in this capitalist society, right? They're there because the two biggest ways, best ways to transfer wealth in this country are through land and insurance policies. There was redlining. There was a time when America gave $10,000 to everybody so that they could buy land and they could stimulate the economy and people could pass that land down and they can have generational wealth. Everybody got it. Immigrants got it. All the white folk got it, but black people couldn't get it. Those $10,000 grants back then are worth $500,000 now. Okay? So you it's a rabbit hole, guy. Homeboy on Zoom was talking about the rabbit hole. I was about to go real deep. I'm pulling myself out of it. Insurance policies, right? We weren't allowed to have to purchase insurance policies. So we were kept out of the whole generational wealth scene. You talk about education and a rite to passage, like our schools suck. Bronx high schools have a 60% dropout rate. 90% of the children who are lucky enough to make it to college drop out. It's intentional. We are in this place, we are in this pit, we are being suffocated intentionally. So we're at a place right now with our new movement, Black Opportunities, and we just said, we're gonna do it ourselves. We opened the school, right? We're hosting workshops to teach our kids about environmental violence, about mindfulness and meditation. And what's amazing about Barbara is I've cited her on Fox News, CNN, in countless articles, and I talked about how yoga and meditation decrease the likelihood of someone committing a violent act. But no one wants to hear that. Our mayor just wants more police. Everybody hears defund the police, they fucking cringe. But if you defund the police and put that money into the community, the crime rate will drop. Even when crime is down, people are still being murdered. Two-year-olds are being shot and killed. Crime is never truly down. It's a hoax. It's a facade. It's a facade. It's a fugazi. Like, what's his name said in Wolf of Wall Street? Right? Like, it's a joke. Crime is never down. And that's because we never approach crime the way we're supposed to. We fight crime. But what we need to be doing is curing poverty.
You talked about the new revolutions, technology, blockchain. Maybe if you guys have thoughts on how tech and data and the various ways of the new revolutions can help.
Absolutely. I'm on a roll. All right. So what we're doing is we're teaching our kids how to code. We're teaching our kids about crypto. Last year, we had a Juneteenth festival, and the theme was financial literacy. We had the actor Hill Harper come in. He gave away crypto and educated people from 6 to like 86 about crypto. And we engaged one of the poorest congressional districts in the world, in the country, in the South Bronx. We engaged them and we taught them about that. This year our theme is environmental injustice, now environmental violence. But what we need our folks to understand, our folks in the hood are familiar with Bitcoin. Everything's Bitcoin. They have no idea what the blockchain is. They have no idea how that operates. So you talk about these industrial revolutions. All of these men who built America, whether it was steel or the railroad or oil, right? We were always left out. This is something we can get in on at the very base level, at the ground level, and we could teach people about it and they can thrive. Like, I'm gonna sound slightly conservative, but fuck welfare, right? It should be a crutch, not a wheelchair. A crutch is something that you use temporarily. You're stuck in a wheelchair forever, right? So if we want to give our people our freedom, our right to breathe, then we have to educate them and give them opportunities.
Thank you.
Is this on?
Yeah, okay.
One of the things that I found that was important for me was I definitely wanted to be part of the legal system because I knew that it was important for survivors to be able to get help. And if we ignored them, then we wouldn't be able to get them the help. And so I wanted to create a system where instead of they go out and arrest them, that they would go out and they would bring them to me and I would offer them services. And through this process, I have been able to help 700 women in the last 6 years. And for me, it was very challenging, you know, to go and sit before the judges and the chief of police and the attorney generals and, you know, and try to get them to grasp this concept. And I was so thankful for the judge who allowed us to be able to do that. And thankful for the organization that that I'm connected with that allowed me that grace to be able to go out there and help build this system. And one of the things, like with the ladies that I work with, for them and me and myself, like if you have been through so much trauma where you can't even comprehend you know, kindness. I don't know I'm sure you can't imagine, but let me just give you an example. So like when I was 12 and I was being trafficked, the trafficker would get up and tell me, "I'm God." And he would drop kick me in my stomach and tell me, "Breathe." And I don't know if you've never been drop kicked in the stomach. If you've been drop kicked in the stomach, you would know if someone drop kicks you in the stomach, you can't breathe. And when I would breathe, he would say, "See, I'll let you breathe." And when you're dealing with somebody who has, that was just a moment in my day. To go through this day after day after day, year after year after year after year, to be violated in ways that people don't even, can't even imagine. And then to have somebody tell you, "You can change. Go get a job. Ain't nothing wrong with you." It just baffles me, man, you know, and it's so confusing to me that because in human trafficking, if a woman is caught being trafficked, she actually has to prosecute in order to get help. And I found that to be so confusing because in domestic violence, they don't. I challenged the police. And I challenge the court system, why is it that she, the one who has been tortured the most, right, beyond human conception, is supposed to stand up now and say, "He did it." What? When her life is still being threatened. Because I don't know if y'all know, but snitches get stitches, but bitches get ditches. You know, so you're asking her to put her life on the line so that you can arrest somebody. And a lot of those prisons, the women that are in prison are women who have been trafficked. Whether it was labor trafficking, because labor trafficking is a thing too. Transporting dope across the country, you know, selling dope. And being forced to do that, that's trafficking. Sexual exploitation, a lot of the children that are in the system, our mothers were trafficked. See, because we try to act like it's something that happened way across the country or way over there. And no, this is a way to get up out the hood, right? For a lot of young black women. And it's a way for exploiters, the Johns and the Tricks and the Pimps, to traffic women who get addicted to drugs. And so we have to continue to try to build systems. I think this, you know, for me, I need the system to work. Because if in Detroit right now, outside of Detroit, there's this attorney general, and I'm going back and forth with him, back and forth with him, and he's trying to, you know, make legalized prostitution in a college town. And I'm fighting him, and I'm doing all type of rallies and, you know, trying to get together, getting all the survivors together. And he just doesn't get it that if you legalize it, now you're saying it's okay. And when you legalize it, you miss the mentally ill. You miss the child that's being trafficked. You miss the familiar trafficked, the gang trafficked. You miss all of them. You miss the drug addicted, because you're saying that only if she says, yes, he's doing this to me right now. He's this guy right here. And that's not even logical. It's so against the grain. No girl who has ever worked the system barely ever tells. We don't tell. Because we don't want to die. We want to continue to breathe. We want to continue to live. And so, there's just one more thing. There's this young girl who was in prison. And it came across my news feed, and it said, child prostitute. And I literally lost it. And so, you know, I contacted Attorney General, because, you know, I'm in this, and I'm just like, look, I need to go see this girl. I need to see what's happening. I need to see what happened. And I told him, I said, you cannot put child and prostitute in the same sentence. It's not, it's immoral, right? And it's against the law. You know what I mean? Your law, the one you created, right? And so anyway, I wrote the warning. I said, I want to come visit her. And he wrote me back and he said, your history has been too unruly to enter this prison. Wow. What did he say that for? Because we went and rallied in Lansing, and then they was calling me, talking about, don't rally, we'll meet you, you know, for dinner, let's talk about it. And I said, I'm gonna meet you, but I'm still gonna rally. And I went in that prison and I walked her up out of there. Wow. And she did 18 months in a program for human trafficking, and she's doing well now. When she was 16 years old, they tried her as an adult. They was giving her 20 years. Because she was on Backpage, because somebody used her as a pawn to rob people. But she had two kids. Anytime, and I told the judge, I'm like, how does a child come before you at six, because she was 15 at the time when they sentenced her. But how does a child come with you with two children and you don't see a problem? She already had two kids. So to me, that's a problem. But anyway, you know, we just got to keep up the fight, and people with good sense and good morals got to stand in the gap. You know what I mean?
Right on.
There's so many things I was thinking when you were speaking. One of the things is mental health, right? The fact that most the people in the communities that we're discussing here do not get treatment, right? They don't even know that there's something going on there. Through so much generational trauma, you know, some of the men that we interview, that we talk to, they're just finding their breath. They're just finding the trauma, the seed that started everything with them, being confused, not knowing, forming their own generational trauma through their own children. They're just finding it. That's why the breath is so freaking important, because without that, you have nothing. You don't know, you're not going to the core. You're not going to the foundation of your existence. These, and all I could talk about is that the fact is that is the place where you find where you at, because this system is broken. This system is truly broken. So where are we going to get fixed here? How are we going to fix this? We have to go to the core. We have to have the faith and to understand that we don't know what we're doing. We don't know, but we know there's something wrong. I talk to so many men, because black men are, you know, they have this whole thing about they can't show they're hurt, they can't show they're confused, they can't show they don't know, they can't show anything. But yet they walk into spaces where people are already judging them. What do you do with that? You go home, you come from a system where your mama, your daddy, your grandfather are all in prison. Who's talking to you? Where are you getting your knowledge? Where are you getting your grace? Where are you getting your worth? Where? Where is it? The only place we can find those things in this broken system is to go to the core of the breath. That may sound simple, and it can be, but it's larger, it's universal, it's global. We're talking to people in other parts of the world that are hanging out in the corner, that don't have anywhere to go. And then when they're told about yoga, they're like, oh, my family won't let me do that because that's Satan. That's voodoo. That's a negative situation. No, the fact is that your family is in a system that wants you to stay broken. So when you're talking, I'm just like, in me, I'm like going, the abuse that we have not disseminated, we need to detoxify that muck that's within us through generations. We need to go in there and dig it out. And the only way we're going to do that is through the breath.
Wow. Thank you so much.
I guess my question to each of you, and you can answer in your own ways, throughout the trials that you've all been through, right, what was it for you that kept you holding on to the light, so to speak, holding on to, as she said, the morals, that strength that kept you, not just to pull yourself out, right, but to like go back and reach back and pull other people out of that. So like, how did that work for you guys?
It's my hatred, right? It's a valid hate that comes from a place of love, right? I hate bullies. I hate bullies. And this government, this system, this world is ran by 1% of the people who have everything. That 1% has more wealth than all of us put together on the whole planet. And they keep us living like that. Because behind racism is classism, and it's just all screwed up. And I don't mean any disrespect to any one of you, but this system is not broken. This system is functioning exactly how it's supposed to function. This is a racist, biased system that is meant to keep black people at the bottom, suffocating, and it's working, okay? They went back, they ended slavery, and 14th Amendment, right? But 13th Amendment said, you still a slave if you go to jail. And then they lock all of us up. I sit here with a law degree, right? I dropped out of high school, went back, got a law degree. But in that time, when I was out in this world, when I was hopeless, I picked up 6 arrests. I know this system inside and out. The first time I went back to the bullpens they had me locked up in, I was working at the district attorney's office, right? Where my supervisors were racist, where the prosecutors were locking people up for smoking joints, but sniffing coke in the bathroom, right? Like, a lot of folks see us as activists who don't know what we're talking about. But like, look at my team, my brother Nadir, who's holding me down, keeping me safe up here, is a talent agent who grew up with a background that enables him to provide security for me. My sister, our co-founder, Shivana Newsom, is an economist and had a successful financial practice and left to fight this revolution. And Steph is just my mentor. I don't like to big him up too much because he'll get a big head. But he's great, and the funny thing about it is I taught him we were on a trip to St. Louis. My mentee. We were on a trip to St. Louis. And we were on a trip to St. Louis, and I called him in the room, and we meditated together. and now he's meditating. You know what I mean? So it's just, we pass it on. But I'm a Christian. You know, I serve Black Jesus. No way Jesus was white in that geographic location, right? And Jesus was on the side of the oppressed, and he fought for the widows. So I do that, right? He went around from town to town holding rallies. It's activism to me, right? Like, feeding people, hello. I just, you know, I'm grounded in Christ.
Living
but
in
I
the
hate
word
bullies.
Of Christ. Huh? Living in Christ.
Amen. Amen.
I feel that.
Can you repeat your question one more time? I got lost in the whole meditation.
No, that's fine. My question was, how did you hold on to the light? What was it that in your darkest moments not only allowed you to pull yourself out, but to, you know, have the strength to go back and pull others out of that darkness?
My ancestors. Mm-hmm. You know, knowing that we're not alone up in here. You know what I'm saying? And they show up and they say a couple of words, or there'll be actions that I could never create in my life that they will show up for me so I can show up for someone else. You know? So I would say that, you know, because in my darkest moments, that's when they appear. And lastly, I would like to say that experience I mentioned to you guys with the children, they saved my life. Even though they came for me, and they were coming, they saved me because I realized that I had a purpose, and that with that purpose, even if I may not ever see them again, hopefully they'll share that with someone else.
It's beautiful. Thank you.
I don't believe that I like had a light or nothing. I embraced the darkness, because when I was on the street and at 2-3 o'clock in the morning, you know, I had there was no hope. We die there. That's the reality. And so and I got help by refusing to leave jail. I refused to leave. And they gave me some grace. I had started hyperventilating. I couldn't breathe, and I did refuse to leave. And I could feel my ancestors rising up in me, because they had said, we're going to give you a 6-year lid. And if you don't know what a 6-year lid is, that means if you get in any trouble, you go straight to the penitentiary for 6 years. Because now I was an habitual criminal, I was a derelict, I had been to jail so many times that I couldn't go back to jail anymore. And so, and it wasn't until I had got very far in my recovery that I went for this challenge. I had written a book many years ago, but I had realized years into my recovery, I'm like, dang. So I seen some on TV and it was talking about human trafficking. And so I started researching what was human trafficking. And then I realized that I was supposed to try to treat human trafficking, but I had never even heard what it was. I didn't even know it existed. And so I figured that there was many other women such as myself who didn't know it existed. And so I didn't even have an internet at the time, or a cell phone, or a television, because I was so content with just being free. But I wouldn't got all these things so that I could connect with other women. And I started connecting with women all over the country. And we were all screaming the same thing. It happened to me. And so our voices became so loud that they had to hear us. See, because before the internet, it was just, oh, well, it just happened to her. You know, it's the poor, poor prostitute. You know what I mean? But when all our voices all over the country were saying the same thing, they had no choice but to hear us. And so I wanted to, like I said before, that I didn't want any other woman to go through her life not knowing that she was a victim and not a criminal. And so for me, it's about building that system where we have to go in there and we have to revamp the whole thing. You know, you're right. It's working exactly, because exactly the way it's supposed to be working, because it is designed to keep her as a hoe. They want you to see her as that. They don't want you to see her as nothing else. And she chose to do it. And because in our world, in our society, we don't want to believe that that's our brother doing that. That's our husband. That's our cousin. That's my nephew. Right? And so the whole thing has to be changed from the inside out. And so, you know, that's what, and I just, that gave me passion, you know, to know that it was somebody taking my place. That was it. That was it for me. To know that it was another 12-year-old that men were lining up to violate, that was enough for me. I didn't care about my reputation or nothing. It didn't mean nothing to me.
Thank you. Thank you all.
Thank you for sharing so much. Oh, is there another question back there?
Oh, she was saying thank you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, thank you guys. I mean, that is, it's so extraordinary to hear each of your stories. And today here, we're working on creating NFTs with breath. And the idea of that is, you know, when we talk about commodification, which is, you know, what you've been dealing with human slavery, modern slavery today, it's that complete commodification of the self. We talk about the prison system and how labor is still being commodified in that way. It's really interesting to me, the idea of NFTs and the new technologies and the ways in which we can take ownership of parts of ourselves in this way, potentially, you know, putting out there. You know, and so it's an experiment to see what happens, you know, whose breath is important, whose breath gets bought at what prices. You know, we don't know what's going to happen with this, but it's really interesting. And I think that aspect of creating art from this deepest part of yourself, you know, hearing, connecting with spirit in that way, but then connecting with breath in this visual way, to me it's really exciting. So I have a last question. If anyone else has a question, please put your hand up. Otherwise, I'll ask mine. So my question, because we're in an art gallery and we have all these amazing artists who've done different works, you know, how does art connect with you and with what you're doing? Is there any thoughts that you want to share about art in this process?
Well, art definitely moves me. Not just moves me, it runs through me. I am art. We are art, you know. I like to thank Al Johnson out there, the artist. That's because we've worked for many years together, and him as a visual artist that speaks truth to power and actually like accesses different dimensions, right? I feel like art takes me, it helps me to travel to different dimensions and to actually interact basically with myself. And in terms of NFTs, I'm so excited about that because I think that that's providing experiences for people to have more exploration with themselves.
I absolutely love art, and thank you for giving us the opportunity to breathe and, you know, get some of this stuff out there. But I absolutely love art. That's why I wrote the book, because I wanted to show that I had the ability to do things, because I was suffering from brain damage and PTSD, and I was told that I wasn't able to learn new things when I tried to go to college. And so I wrote the book, and then I created programs. And for me, it was like the ability to be able to create something that nobody could even conceive, that had way more, you know, degrees and experience at this civil society you guys live in. Because, see, I'm just a visitor here, right? Right? But to watch it grow and watch it touch and heal, and it's amazing. Yeah.
Wow. I just love art, like all of its forms. I'll never forget the first time I fell in love with art. I was at a college in upstate New York, and me and my roommate had just smoked some weed, and we went outside, and it was like the whole campus was getting on these buses, and we're like, what the fuck is going on? And they're like, oh, it's museum day, and we were like, oblivious. So we jumped in a friend's car and we smoked and we drank wine. And we went to the Goog. And I was like, I don't know if it's because I'm high or what, but this art is just dope. Like, this is way out. And I haven't smoked or drank in years, but I still go to the museums, right? But art has always played a major part in our activism. There is always spoken word. There's always music. There are songs that inspire me in my activism, like Public Enemy, Fight the Power, NWA, Fuck the Police. Yeah, I said it. I live that shit. There's just so much. Like, there's just so much. And to think, like, I gotta thank you, Johnny, GK, Penn, everybody who's involved. Like, yo, to walk up in this space, right, gallery, and just to see me on a wall, right, is like one of the dopest things ever. I go to these places to be enriched and enlightened and to experience, and I'm part of the experience, and it's for my art, right? I'm an artist, the streets, the people, without this liberation, this fight, that's my canvas. So this is special. Thank you.
That's wonderful. And I just wanted to add, I just forgot to say that we came out with a book called Release and Become, where I meditated on the artwork, the abstract expressionist artwork of Al Johnson, and provided words, quotes, and healing modalities through the book. And in the book, we have people from all over the world, like the United Nations Ambassador Chowdhury, many people from India, Bangalore, India, from the design team in Bangalore, India, and other parts of the world that contributed, showing and talking about where is their healing moments, where are their breaths. And in the back of the book is essential oils to use for healing, self-healing. So I forgot that even happened, but that was very exciting for us to explore that, and we're going to expound on that through NFTs and AR experiences. Thank you.
And you can also get my book. It's called Out of the Darkness by Alice J. It's on Amazon.
And you can get my NFT, which has a piece of my soul in it. You know, I'm kidding.
All right, well, thank you so much. And thank you, Eduardo and Aaron, for inviting me here today. And thank you, all of our wonderful panelists, for sharing your breaths, your souls with us. Really, really honored to get to talk with you tonight. Thank you.